This is a special edition of the Bioethics Channel. In recent days, debate over healthcare reform has started to focus on a particular provision in the bill that relates to advanced care planning. And opponents of healthcare reform and opponents of this provision have claimed, among other things, that this particular bill would promote euthanasia amongst our nation's seniors. Joining us now is the president and CEO of the Center for Practical Bioethics, Myra Christopher. Myra, first, your general reaction about some of these claims that are going back and forth now.
Well, I think that, number one, they are not well-founded in fact. And number two, I think they're politically charged and motivated. And they sadden me in a real way. Anyone who knows anything about the Center for Practical Bioethics knows that since our beginning, we have worked in collaboration with healthcare professionals and with lawyers and policymakers and with consumer advocates to promote the concept of advanced care planning. And by that, I mean simply that families talk with one another about their goals and their values, whatever they are, with regard to treatment preferences at the end of life, and that they get clear about what they want. It doesn't matter what people want, whether they want to make an advance directive in order to protect themselves from unwanted treatment, or if they want to make an advance directive so that they are confident that they will get all the treatment that they desire at the end of life, but also that they decide among themselves who they would want to be their surrogate or their agent in the event that they could no longer decide for themselves, that they could no longer engage with their doctor in decision-making. So we've all worked very hard on this, as have many other organizations, and we also know that the vast majority of adults in this country believe that this is an important right, the right to be self-determining, the right to choose or refuse any medical or surgical treatment. And so now that this has become a component of healthcare reform, there is a group of people who I believe are highly motivated for political reasons to step in and try to really undo healthcare reform because of this very emotional appeal to people, this effort to scare and to frighten people about something that is simply not true.
So it has to be professionally and personally frustrating to you. The center has been working on this for 25 years, as you say, with a lot of different organizations, to see it mischaracterized this way.
It is both. I find it quite disgusting, to be candid with you.
So let's talk about exactly, specifically, what this bill does call for. And one of these provisions does call for a consultation every 5 years. Could you explain that a little
right.
bit?
And there are multiple bills, actually, Laurel. And that's one of the things that really kind of makes me crazy right now, is that people talk about things that they don't really know about. At this point, as you know, we have reform legislation coming out of three committees in the House, but we don't yet have legislation, healthcare reform legislation, coming out of the Senate. But with regard to advanced illness legislation, we have legislation in the Senate and in the House. We have legislation from Senator Rockefeller in the Senate. It's sponsored bipartisan legislation, actually. We have sponsors on both sides of the aisle, as we like to say. We have legislation in the Senate also from Senator Mark Warner as the primary sponsor. Then in the House, we also have legislation that would fall under this category from Representative Blumenauer. And we have a bill that's now being referred to as the House Tri-Committee Bill, which refers back to this bigger reform legislation, that all include provisions around advanced care planning. Now, some of the bills that I have referred to include other things. They include things about professional education, about end-of-life care, about how to do a better job of palliative care. They include legislation about reimbursement. They include a number of other components. But the thing that I would say, and I use these terms quite intentionally, the fear-mongers and the demagogues have latched on to is this thing about advanced care planning. So let's talk about that specifically and in a focused way. The legislation in, and I'm going to combine Rockefeller and Warner's legislation, if you'll forgive me, but basically it provides for consumer education. And the legislation says that primary care providers would be provided with compensation for engaging in dialogue, for talking with their patients. Now, this is the physician that the patient usually sees. This is not a bureaucrat from Washington, as some people have claimed, but that your doctor would receive compensation for talking with you about what your goals and values are at the end of life in the event you could not engage with him or her in such a conversation. One of the things that doctors often tell us as or give to us as a reason for why they don't usually do this is that, as we all know, doctors have very limited time now to engage in with their patients. And they say, I want to do this, I just don't have time to do it. And I don't get reimbursed for doing this. And primary care doctors in our country today really don't make a lot of money. So as a means of addressing this or overcoming this barrier, Rockefeller and Warner have said, well, let's provide a financial incentive to physicians so that they feel comfortable in taking the time to talk to their patients, their regular patients, about this. And they've said, you know, reasonably, people change their minds from time to time. So we'll provide reimbursement to them every 5 years in the context of their usual relationships. Now, there's some other provisions as well. There is, in Warner's legislation, there is a hotline so that, you know, in the middle of the night, if you're worried about this, you could pick up the phone and you could call somebody and tell me about this. But this is generally directed towards the usual physician-patient relationship. Now, the idea of having an online education, I think, is a good idea. But some people seem to think that education is somehow a dangerous proposition. We don't. But there is some reimbursement in the legislation to fund development of materials so that people do have access to information through the Department of HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, or through the department or through the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. And in fact, the Center for Practical Bioethics has been working with both of these agencies for a number of years on these very issues.
Now, Myra, there's been some talk about how living wills works into this, and maybe there's been some confusion over that as well.
There's been a lot of confusion because living will is a term that most Americans know. It was the first iteration of an advance directive. But over the years, I think, frankly, we've gotten a little more sophisticated about this. And so people then started talking about, well, really what we're talking about is healthcare treatment directives, or we're talking about advanced medical directives. Advanced directive is the broad generic term that actually is kind of the bucket in which you could put all of these documents, a living will, a medical treatment directive, a healthcare treatment directive. What we have come to believe is most important is probably a document called a durable power of attorney for healthcare, which is a document that names someone that the patient trusts, usually a spouse or an adult child, but it doesn't have to be. It could be your best friend, to make decisions for you if you can't be self-determining, if you can't make your own decisions. Then you can say, you know who I really, really trust to make these decisions? That person is my daughter, Mary, or my husband, John, or my very best friend, Susie. And you can make this document, and then that gives the doctor the confidence that that's the person you would want him or her to talk with.
So other than some of the payment provisions in all these various bills,
there's nothing new here.
Nothing new, and it's essentially been something that the center has been talking about for the last 25 years. Does the language vary much from?
No, not at all. Not at all. And, you know, just last night I had an email that was kind of an emergency email that everybody has gotten all up in arms because there's legislation. In the legislation, there was a provision that talked about that these decisions could be made even if the decision would mean that it would hasten death. Well, this actually goes back to the Cruzan decision, which was decided in 1990. It was a U.S. Supreme Court decision, which is now, nearly 30 years old, 29 years old. Next year will be, no, is that right?
19
years.
Almost 20
years. My math
years.
Is off here. Next year will be
math
20
isn't
years.
Math is your strong
suit. Well,
there.
Actually it is, but I'm so emotional about this, I'm not thinking very clearly. But that comes from the U.S. Supreme Court decision. So it's not that anyone is trying to hasten anyone's death. It is that they're allowing natural death to occur. That people can make a decision to withhold or withdraw artificial life support, life-sustaining treatment, even if it means that withdrawing that treatment means that death might come sooner than later. Now, when I was asked about this yesterday afternoon, and was asked, what other language could you use? I thought, we could talk about not prolonging the dying process, which is something that many people are very concerned about.
And can relate to very easily.
And can relate to easily. I think many of us have seen people, when we know that it is not what they want, that they would choose. When they are in intensive care units, for example, for long periods of time, and sometimes when we believe that person is gone from us and that it is contrary to what they want, but they continue to be tethered to machines, hooked up to ventilators, and yet we find great difficulty in allowing that person to die as they perhaps would have chosen to.
Now, this debate will continue into the month of March 2009. Opportunities, I guess, exist for people to educate themselves and educate others on this. Is that what you would call for?
Absolutely, that is what I call for. You know, I really do not care if people want everything that a physician or a hospital can provide to them. It is their choice. I also do not care if people want to choose to leave the hospital and go home and die with their family, their pets around them. It is their choice. What I want desperately, however, is for people to be able to decide in a manner that is consistent with who they are and what they want, not what the reimbursement system provides for. Not what technology does, not what doctors necessarily want.
Not if it might save money for Medicare or something like that.
No. Or not if it might cause more money to be made by someone else. I want it to be that which is congruent with the patient's goals and values, whether those are religious values, whether those are values that come from family tradition. I do not care. But what I care about greatly is that the individual decides and that people not be frightened by, frankly, folks who have not been present in the end-of-life movement for the last 30 years that I've been working on this, who now run in at the 11th hour and try to frighten people and say that this is about killing the frail, the elderly, and the sick. It is a lie.
Myra Christopher is the president and CEO of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about this issue, go to our website at practicalbioethics.org. Practicalbioethics.org, and you'll also find on there a summary of the various bills that address this issue on both the Senate side and the House side. This has been a special edition of the Bioethics Channel. I'm Laurel LeBoux, your host. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.